Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It's time to take a look at the world of birds and birding on the program. Bill Volkert back with us, retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for more than 27 years, I believe, and written a number of books, has led many bird watching tours, and been a regular on this show for a long, long time. Great to have him back. And certainly great to have you listening in. And maybe you want to tell us about the birds you're seeing this time of the year. Maybe you have a question about identifying a bird. You can join the conversation a couple of ways. One way is to call us at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email and a photo. If you've got a bird photo you want to identify, we can do that as well. Just go to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about fledgling birds. July is fledgling bird season, is it not?
Well, that's what AI like to think of it. Now, of course, we always have birds that are a little out of sync as early nesters and others that may nest a little later in the year as part of their natural habits. But if we look at most of our songbirds, April and May is a migration season. June is really the nesting season. They're ending the nesting as we get into July. Fledging is the time that the young are leaving the nest. As we get into August, that starts to be what I think of as a flocking season.
Yeah.
And then birds start moving late August, September, and of course, so the geese and swans way into November, even December, as they're moving out. So yeah, this is the time the nesting season is coming to a close, but it's still time long before the actual migration begins. So birds are no longer tied right to that nest site. They're starting to move around a little more. The young are maturing, and they're starting to now move into other areas where there's food available for them, and they're strengthening themselves. And slowly, there'll be preparation for the migration.
So how independent are these young birds?
They will depend on the adults, and this is for songbirds, a couple of weeks that they'll feed them out of the nest. You know, some of the birds, like, say, Eastern Phoebe is known to have more than one brood in a year. Bluebirds certainly do. So you only want to raise those kids for about so long, get them on their own, and start the next family. So oftentimes it can be as little as 2 weeks. So for most songbirds, we have a period of incubation, which is about equal to the same time that they have for rearing in the nest until fledging. So say a robin is about 16, 18 days to incubate the eggs, another 16 to 18 days that the young are in the nest and raised, and then say 2, at the most maybe 3 weeks that the adults are feeding them as they're begging outside of the nest to become independent. And then, hey, kids, you're on your own, and they may start another family.
You know, I when they're in that stage, I mean, it's pretty tough at times to identify them as to what bird we're looking at here.
Oh, yeah, definitely. A very common one, our chipping sparrow, is easily recognized with that rusty cap, nice gray breast. The young ones have fine speckled breasts, and they really lack that distinctive cap and that stripe through the eye. Looks like quite a different bird. So, yeah, that becomes really challenging. So just to identify all the adult birds and recognize males from females where there's different plumage is one thing. The juveniles is a whole other thing.
There aren't any books out there or apps that one could use, are there?
Are there? Well, again, some of them will be more comprehensive than others. And if you're using the Merlin app, there are quite a few pictures of juveniles. Of course, what stage, you know, from just leaving the nest to that immature plumage, like the robin with that speckling on the breast until they eventually will molt and get the characteristic reddish breast. They may have a number of those pictures of young birds. That's becoming more common because you can certainly sight a lot of them at this time of year.
Yeah.
And I would, again, always recommend for people who have any interest in identifying birds, use the Merlin app.
Yeah.
It is a great little pocket field guide, and you also have the sound identification, which is just amazing.
Speaking of sound, the birds are kind of quiet this time of the year.
Yeah, you know, if you wake up right around sunrise, say a month ago or even back in May, we have that morning chorus where everybody's just tuning up and they're singing so many at one time, it's hard to almost filter them out. it's getting a little quieter. A cardinal here, a robin there, an eastern peewee. These are birds that will sing, but they're no longer attracting a mate. So there isn't that urgency to declare a territory, to announce that. And that's what that vocalization is about.
Bruce in Algoma has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I've been dying to get a question out there.
All right.
I have a 100-acre field that's been fallow for 30 years, and the topography is changing. I red twig and all this other stuff is coming. But I used to have a significant population of bobolinks that would show up every year. The last 2 years, significantly less. Is the changing nature of my land influencing that, or is it just something to do with their numbers?
Maybe a little of both. Bobolinks are birds that use the open field. So if you're getting more and more brush, it's becoming less attractive to them. So, yeah, certainly you want a more of an open, sweeping landscape without all that heavy brush cover in there. So that may be certainly one thing that's deterring them. And bobolinks, they're not on the endangered list, but these are birds that are somewhat under pressure because they are so specialized, needing these open fields, formerly the prairies. That's becoming less available as we have changed from pasturing cattle to hay cutting.
Yeah.
This oftentimes takes place during the nesting season. And they're also very long-distance migrants. They winter down in the Argentine Pampas, so there's a lot of challenges to make those long flights.
Is that a bobolink we're listening?
That's the chip calls. The real bobolink song is where they get the name.
Song.
Yeah, very bubbly. Yeah, it's a beautiful song.
Bruce, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us with a question or even a photo to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org.
A quick follow-up for Bruce. If he does want to bring back the bobolinks, they oftentimes are very traditional to where they want to come back to. So clearing out that brush and trying to restore it more to open grassland might be able to bring them back again and make it more attractive.
Yeah, that is a very good idea. Well, gosh, you mentioned migrating earlier. I mean, it's so hard in the first week, you know, of August to talk about, they're starting to migrate already.
Yeah. Well, most birds are not, and it'll be a while before they depart here because right now we still got quite a bit of summer and early fall, which means food is very abundant. And, of course, it gives them that much extra time to not only take advantage of the local resources, but also to strengthen up and prepare for it. But we do already see the very first of the migrants showing up, and those are the sandpipers, the shorebirds. And these are Arctic breeders. And what you have here is a different type of breeding strategy, similar to what, say, ducks, pheasants, turkeys use, which is where the female is rearing the young. And these are what we call precocial young. So when they hatch out, they're fully feathered and they'll start to run away from the nest. Unlike, say, the robin blue jay, where they're born or hatched out in a very immature state. And then the parents have to raise them in the nest. And that's why you need both of the parents, for the most part, to feed and rear those young. So like with ducks, the male is brilliantly colored because that makes him the most attractive for a mate. But the female sure doesn't want him around when you've got young because he just looks like a target.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very camouflaged, as are the young. And the parents then are not raising the young by feeding them directly. They're providing more of a guardianship, taking them to safe areas and where there's food. So you don't have to have both parents around. For ducks, by the way, at this time of year, they're also the males are losing their feathers and they go through what we call a complete molt. In other words, they will slowly over time, just like the Canada geese that you'll see out on the parklands and uplands, they'll start shedding all of their feathers in July, and they become flightless for a period. And so for a mallard, if you've got a bright green head and you can't fly, well, that gets dangerous. So he actually mimics the female, sheds the body feathers too, becomes what we call eclipse plumage, becomes more camouflage. And then regrows those feathers. So because these are fast-flying birds, they want a full complement of flight feathers. They can't afford to lose one at a time. For Canada geese, the same way, the adults start to shed them as the young are out of the nest. And of course, for several weeks, they won't be able to fly anyhow. So it's a good time for the parents to lose their feathers. And that's why they'd be feeding then very close to water, because you can always run to water, which is safe.
Yeah. Gray and Appleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Yeah, I just had a quick question about books to read about birds in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than just the identification books that just show a photo and, you know, differentiating between female and male, I was wondering if you had any book recommendations that went more into depth about behavior or, you know, personality or anything like that about birds in the Wisconsin area.
Well, years ago, there were these Stokes guides that had a little brief thing about behavior of each bird. You can see if those are still available. There's always new books coming out. If you're traveling around Wisconsin at any of the parks or nature centers, I would go into the gift shop, take a look what's available. They oftentimes carry quite a few of the local ones. Another good source for birding books for libraries is Beautio Books, which is a book dealer out east. They've got a massive online library. You can check there as well. It's a huge topic. Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff out there. And there also there's the individual life history. So if you're interested in either a particular species or a family of birds, there's specialized books on those topics as well.
So lots out there.
Yeah, and some of the very old classics, because these were well studied a long time ago, and bird behavior doesn't change. So even what was written in the 40s and 60s is still relevant today. And, of course, they're repackaging a lot of these things,
yes,
making it a little more accessible. And a lot of that stuff is also online. Yep.
Thank you very much for calling. Lois in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Lois.
Hi there. I saw a Bolek oriole the other day, and I found out they're very rare. And I know I have orioles all the time, so I know it's not a typical oriole that Baltimore or whatever or orchard. So just FYI, I didn't get a picture, unfortunately.
Okay, well, that's good. That's an interesting sighting. Bolek's oriole is the western counterpart of our Baltimore oriole. So we have Baltimore oriole in the eastern United States, central U.S. We've got the open prairies. Well, it's not a good place for a forest bird. And as you get into the western forested areas, the Bolek's oriole takes its place. We hear them chattering out there. Very nice.
Yeah,
little.
It's nice that Jeff had a little chattering going on while you were talking. That's cool.
And it's not a common bird here because they have to cross the prairies and or those central states. We'll have a few sightings in, say, Minnesota, Wisconsin over the years.
Lois, thanks again for calling.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator, talking birds with him. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email your photo or your question to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at the world of birds and birding with Bill Volkert. Join in. If you got an email, you could email a photo or a question to talk@WPR.org. And we did get an email from Mary, photo of what she found while doing checks and cleanouts of birdhouses, and she found 3 expired birds there, I think, Bill.
Yeah, those look to be the immature or the young fledglings of the tree swallow, or actually more nestlings. They haven't even fledged. And there was a little bit of a cautionary note this year for people with martin houses, and it probably applies as well for the tree swallows. All the heavy rain that we've had made it difficult for the adults to be able to feed. They're what we call aerial insectivores. In other words, they got to fly around and catch the insects out of the air. Well, when it's raining out, there's not much flying, and it's very difficult to capture that kind of food. And there actually was some starvation of young this year because of the exceptional amount of rain. It just made it tough to go out and find enough food during those weather events.
Sad. But it's good to have the explanation. I hadn't thought of it, but that rain, you're right. We had so much rain.
Yeah, it's just off the charts. And on the other hand, it was also a pretty good year for duck nesting. So DNR always and Fish and Wildlife Service do the continent-wide duck surveys. And what they're doing is they're flying the same route, looking at the number of spring ponds, the flooded wetlands out there. So take a look at available habitat, and then they'll be also looking for the adult pairs on the ponds, how many are out there. So we certainly had a lot of water, which means a lot of the wetlands had water. And for a water bird, that's always spells good news for them. So it seems like they had a good nesting season. One thing to keep in mind is when we do these surveys, we always refer to wildlife counts as surveys. When we count people, that's a census. Mm-hmm. And the difference is a census is we're trying to get an exact
everybody.
Count. Everybody. Wildlife, you can't count them all. You just can't walk in the woods and find them all. So what we're trying to do is our best way of how can we find a good representative number, and then we look at relative change. Are they up a bit or down a bit from the average over the years? We still don't know the exact number. We can try to mathematically extrapolate. It becomes a guess of how many are in the population, but we can take a look at the percentage of change. Are they doing better this year or a little worse than they have done over the years? And that's really how those surveys are then analyzed.
Christy in Chippewa County, your turn. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
An observation and two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday afternoon, it was incredibly hot and humid, as you remember, and I was sitting by my wall of glass that overlooks purple coneflowers, a couple of water features, and cedars, and I noticed a very small bird flit into the coneflower that were within 3 feet just on the other side of the glass, and the bird was below me. It was clearly smaller than a chickadee, and it perched where I could see a view from above, and it had a bright yellow crown. It had a black mask. It had white mustache and eyebrow. Its back was gray, dark gray, had mm-hmm. a small dark.
Excellent description.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. I didn't dare flinch.
And you're talking about the black mask across the face? That's a common yellow throat, which is one of our warblers. They're mostly found in wetland edges and tall standing wetland scrub and grasses. And they will also come into the uplands a little bit. So that's blue-wing warbler.
Yeah.
This is common yellowthroat, which is the witchetty. So your tall coneflowers and prairie plants out there provide a kind of an attractive little feeding area for it. Good for you.
Yeah. Good for you, Christy.
Another question?
A closer look, I was convinced it was a golden wing warbler, but I'll go back to my field guides and cross-reference that. Question is that, mm-hmm. I mean, consistently each morning, May, June, July, mid, early July, indigos and bluebirds,
mm-hmm.
and they seem to have disappeared. I don't know if they're on their nest and really quiet, or they just left my wooded lot.
Could be either one. Indigo bunting is an interesting one because when they arrive in springtime, they will hit feeders for the first week or two. And I hear this all the time. Where do they all go? There it is, that paired notes.
Mm-hmm.
Too high, down, up, down, up, down. Always two quick notes. Well, what you have is a very brilliant, deep indigo blue bird, which, of course, is the reflected light. If he's sitting in a tree or on a power line above you, the light is hitting its back. He looks black. So you don't see those colors. So you have to have the right angle to really see the bird, for one. And they like to nest in the dense tree cover. So you'll see them in springtime as the leaves are just emerging and the birds are arriving. And then it seems as if they all disappear. But if you listen for them, you'll find they're actually fairly widespread. Mm. And so that's how we really do our surveys for them. It's almost all by sound.
Thank you, Christy.
So do learn that song, yes.
Yeah. Linda emailed a photo while kayaking the Plover River in Stevens Point yesterday.
Yes.
Is this an osprey?
Yes, it is. Also called fishhawk is a generic name for it. Yeah, that's osprey. It is a bird that has been on our state threatened list. It has been recovering fairly well over the last 40 years in Wisconsin. And it is a specialist. It does feed exclusively on fish.
Yeah. She also mentioned that they used the Merlin app and recorded 8 different birds in 10 minutes.
Oh, there you go.
Had to put the phone away to pay attention to her kayaking.
Yeah.
Samantha in Whitehall, it's your turn. Hi, Samantha.
Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, my grandma passed away in 2014, but she had a good knowledge of like what bird sounds, you know, what this bird, that bird. I know what a chickadee sounds like, but other than that, I'm not sure. Now she's gone. Now this day and age, you know, what's a good place to look and try to study some of the birds, especially the ones in like Minnesota, Wisconsin, so that if you're out and about, you mm-hmm. can tell what this or this or this or this. And I'll take my answer off air. I just want to know what to look for. So.
Well, it's a very good question, and we were just talking about the Merlin app, and there's basically two approaches you can use to learn bird songs. You can do it the way I did, which is the hard way. Listen to everything you hear, walk out there, look at it, identify which bird is making what sound, and try to memorize that. And that can take you literally decades, and what took me 25 years or more to learn, you can now download the Merlin app. It's from Cornell University. Put it on your cell phone. You just hold that up, put on song ID or sound ID. Hit that, it's recording the sounds, and it will identify, there'll be a little picture icon of every bird that it's hearing. And then you can go to that bird and actually listen to the recorded songs, songs and calls. And my brother's been using that. He's always been impressed with my ability to be able to identify songs. He just shakes his head about it. And now he's sitting there with his phone. He goes, I got this and that. And it made it very easy for him. He didn't have to go through it the hard way I did. So, yeah, I've run into a number of people that have really kind of explored and been open to the world of bird sounds with the Merlin app. Strongly recommended. It's great.
Rita in Wisconsin Rapids emailed to say they noticed catbirds in their yard for the first time, wondering if they're prevalent in the Wisconsin Rapids area.
Yes, and we have a vocalization here for a catbird.
We do.
It's one of the mimics, and he's a chatty bird. On and on. He'll just go on. This is a long song, yeah. And occasionally the meow that you hear in there, which is where he gets his name. Catbird loves the nest in thick shrubs, just like cardinals. So, yeah, a lot of forest edges and heavy shrubbery. These are common nesting places. And now they'll migrate down into, say, Mexico, northern Central America. They're pretty widespread across Wisconsin, but since they're living in these dense shrubs, they can make a lot of noise and really hide, like we talked about with indigo bunting earlier. Hard to see when all the vegetation's out, easy to hear. And if you... want to make it easy, let's, you know, on yourself, go back to the Merlin app. You'll be able to hear those birds. They're actually fairly widespread across Wisconsin.
Andrew in Madison, your turn. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding house sparrows. I started really disliking them when I saw them kicking out my house wrens out of their nest, and now my house wrens seem to be less prevalent, and the sparrows are all over. I was wondering if there any way to get rid of them, or what do you have to say about house sparrows?
Well, house sparrows, of course, are not native to North America. It is a European, Eurasian species. The name house sparrow is because they oftentimes are nesting around human dwellings, so they're in the cities. Yes, they will make their nests in cavities or overhangs of houses and so forth. And, yeah, they can be a competitor for house wrens and also for our bluebirds. The best thing there is the monitoring of your boxes and try to discourage the house wren from setting up shop. And if you put up more than one box, you oftentimes will have a chance for the house wren to try to nest in one and the house sparrow to try to occupy another, and then you can manage it. If you're looking for hints for managing cavity nesting songbirds, I would go to the Bluebird Restoration Association website. It's certainly focused on bluebirds, but there's some really good hints if you have tree swallows, as we saw the picture earlier, house wrens and other cavity nesters. And you put up a box, you may have any one of those using it as well, depending on your particular neighborhood. So the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, go to their website. There's a lot of good hints of house designs, how to monitor them, and how to manage them, and how sparrows are addressed there.
Great site. Andrew, thank you. Kurt in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about... robin nests. I had a robin that nested in the peak of my garage. There's a little attic space up there. And I watched the nest being built, and I'm like, oh, that's nice. And eventually there were birds in there and eggs in there, and then I saw her feeding or him feeding little birds. Well, I was up in that garage, and there was a moth trapped up there, and I thought, I'll force it out this window. So I moved that screen, and those robins, it must have been both of them, were just going nuts, the adults. And I stuck the screen back in. The moth did go out. I should have just dealt with the moth, but I thought I would try to give it a chance to get out. And I don't know. It was probably within a week, my wife goes, oh, those birds are gone. It looks like that nest is done. And so in the back of my mind, I'm wondering, did I cause them to abandon that nest with that little activity? The birds looked, you know, the babies looked like they were a good size, mm-hmm. but I couldn't get a good look at them. They didn't look chubby and fluffy like some chicks look. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the question, is that what happened? Or because I don't see how they could move the nest either when the birds are so big they wouldn't have been. It's
not no, like they're not going to do that. Usually that short-term disturbance is not going to give birds a cause to completely abandon a nest. So even for bird banding, we've done that with bluebirds in the nest box. So we can open it up, get in there, band the young, or, as I mentioned earlier, the Bluebird Restoration Association will recommend monitoring of the nest. You can open it up, take a look in there, count the number of eggs, take a look at the young, a quick peek in there. Yeah, the parents may, as you had them, you know, really freak out and be bombarding you and become very defensive and aggressive while you're there. They don't want you around, but they'll be really relieved as soon as you leave. So that short term should not have really given them cause to abandon. I would imagine they were probably close enough. And you said within a week they were gone, probably grew up that quick and were out of the nest. Now, another myth that comes up is if you touch a bird nest or bird egg, the parents can smell that and abandon it. For the most part, birds don't have a good sense of smell. Vultures and some of the seabirds do, but otherwise songbirds, it is not a well-developed sense for them. The myth is probably holds a little bit of true because I think that kids, it's the curiosity. Oh, I found a nest. I want to show my friends. I want to see how they're doing. That repeated intrusion and proximity to the nest, then the parents may get the feeling, this is not the safe hidden place that I thought it was. We'd be better off to abandon it and start somewhere else. And usually that's early in the nesting when you have just eggs. They're looking for a secure place. They may abandon them. Once they've invested so much time to rear those young, they're getting grown, they put all that energy into it, and they're all just about ready to leave. It takes a little bit more disturbance for them to actually abandon. So I would imagine they just fledged on their own.
Singing about last year on my morning trot around the neighborhood in the early morning, I'm going along and I go by this one bush and suddenly I get whacked in the back of my head by a bird.
So, he's probably doing that for every pedestrian in that neighborhood.
I turned around to try and look and see it. I saw the bird, but it was quickly back into the bush, and I didn't see what it was even. It hit me 2 days in a row.
That reminds me of an interesting story. There was a fella in the biology department at one of the smaller campuses around Wisconsin who was studying red-winged blackbirds. There were some ponds on campus, and he was banding the birds in the ponds, and interestingly, of all the students that were walking around, the red-winged blackbirds learned to recognize him as a threat and would dive bomb him, and students would be walking by and they would ignore him. So they actually picked him out of the crowd that this guy is a danger and nobody else is. So interesting behavior.
Kurt, thanks again. Jolie and Mosinee will go to you. Hi, Jolie.
Hello. Just wanted to mention, in Mosinee here, we've been having those white pelicans flying around. And I think they're going into the backwaters of the river, plus going over in the backwaters down farther of the river. And they fly low, and there's been a dozen or so. And just this morning, there were six of them flying low. Is that something that they're coming back, or what is with them?
Yeah.
Well, we've talked about pelicans in the past. We've had periodic sightings over the many years throughout the there's the grunting of them on the nest site. not the best vocalization there. He sings like I do. But pelicans, they started to show up in Wisconsin in increasing numbers in the 1990s, beginning a nest in Green Bay first, then at Horicon Marsh. And over the years, we've had more and more nesting sites established in some of the larger water areas and along the Mississippi River. These are birds that do not begin to nest until they're probably about 4, 5, even 6 years old. So we do see the non-breeders, the immature birds, moving around in these flocks. They tend to feed in a flock and essentially do it by herding. So they'll look for small minnow swarms and schools, and then the pelicans will spread out, start to herd them all together, and that's where they use that bucket mouth to just scoop.
Yeah.
So unlike a heron who's looking for an individual fish and will dart out and grab that prey item, these guys are just concentrating the food and just start scooping, and you'll get something in your mouth. So, yeah, interesting. And it is a somewhat newer nesting species in Wisconsin over the last 25 years or so.
Thanks again, Jolie. Brad in Osceola, we'll go to you now. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about bird feeding about mm-hmm. this time of the year. We bird feed pretty much year-round, but I'm kind of wondering if it is best to back off a little bit when the young birds are, you know, learning to eat and stuff like that. Otherwise, they get acclimated to just the feeder and not do the wild feeding.
Probably not. There's also been this story and concern that, well, if we feed hummingbirds late into the fall, that they'll become so dependent on food they won't leave. They'll leave regardless of the food. And in fact, for some that remain a little late in the season, it may be the lifeline before they actually get the signal to head out. For the most part, feeding is for our enjoyment. I always think of it as fast food. It's there. It's convenient. Yeah, we may all stop quickly to grab something. It's not the healthiest thing, and you wouldn't want to live on it. But it is a way to bring the birds in. And studies have indicated that probably 75 to 80% of a bird's diet, even in wintertime, is from the wild. This is just something that's convenient and easy for them. They don't need it. And it's also probably not doing any serious harm. We've never been able to bear that out, that we shouldn't be. The biggest concern I would have is during this hot, humid weather, make sure that every so often, probably every couple of weeks, when your feeders are completely empty, you might want to disinfect. Get some warm water bleach, rinse them out, give it a good clean rinse, let them dry completely and start over, because we don't want spoilage of food or accumulation of bird droppings where we might have an individual carrying a disease to an area where we're concentrating birds. That's probably the biggest danger that we have with bird feeding.
Brad, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phyllis in the town of Dunn, we'll go to you now. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. So I was riding my bike on one of Dane County's many wonderful bike trails, and I went by quickly, but I saw something that was really strange, and it was a bird. I think it was a robin. And it was perfectly still on a bush, and its mouth was open. And I thought, it's dead. I think a butcher bird put it there. So I just looked it up, and it says we are in the area. I had no idea that shrikes or butcher birds were in this area. And I wonder if you think that's what I saw.
Well, the shrike, or the folk name butcher bird, it comes from them impaling their prey because they don't have strong feet like hawks or owls to hold it. So they'll actually impale it on a thorn or barbed wire or wedge it in a little shrub to hold it so they can then pull it apart, a prey item that's too big to swallow whole. There are two species of shrikes in North America, the northern shrike, which is nesting in Canada and is a winter visitor to Wisconsin, so wouldn't be here now, and loggerhead shrike, that is a southern species. It is on the endangered list for Wisconsin, very rare. So we're, first of all, at the far northern edge of its range to begin with, and we've seen some decline over the years. And there's that little call, just a real simple little high whistle or peep out of the bird. I would probably rule out shrike as fairly likely because we just don't have a lot of them here, especially this time of the year. Doesn't mean it's impossible. Very little in the natural world is. But you say the bird was dead. Sometimes what you will find is in this hot weather, birds will sit, they'll spread their feathers out to do some sunning, to try to get a little bit of air and sunlight on below the feathers. kind of like getting a good massage. And the other thing is sometimes they'll just sit there and they'll just pant. They'll just sit with their mouth wide open and just to try to relieve themselves from the heat and the sun.
Yeah, so that may be what you saw as well, Phyllis. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us a question or photo to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Bill Volker for WPR News. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we learn how to avoid passport scams, and then we'll talk about how military veterans can access the benefits and resources they need. That's tomorrow on the show. Right now, we're looking at birds and birding with our guest, Bill Volkert. If you have a question or an experience to share, give us a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Bill, the spring waterfowl survey came out from the DNR. They released some data from the annual spring survey of breeding waterfowl. How does the DNR use this information?
Well, because we have a hunted species, they want to be able to find out how many birds are being produced for the year that will provide us then the allowable hunt. So essentially, if you're hunting any species, a couple of things you need to know is how many are out there, how many young are they raising, what is your population goal? Do you want to maintain the number of individuals, whether it's deer or ducks or geese that you have? Do you want to allow it to increase or do you want to decrease it? So you need to know how many are there. You want to set your goal as to where what you want to achieve. And then you want to take a look at the number of young they produce and what is surviving, what is added to the population. For birds like our ducks and geese, and for most wildlife, hunting is considered to be what we call compensatory mortality. In other words, a fair percentage of those individuals that are born this year are going to die of natural causes anyhow. And whether we shoot one first or it dies from something else later on, hunting is not a major impact. There are a few, especially long-lived species that have very few young, take a long time to mature, that we refer to as additive mortality. So there isn't a real big loss of it. And hunting is, we have to be much more conservative because it is adding to the natural mortality. So then what you want to do is you're looking, first of all, at your breeding pairs and your wetlands. You're flying over. What are the conditions of the wetlands? Are there a lot of them there with a lot of water that is at least potential brood water and habitat? And how many birds are sitting on it to occupy it? Then by midsummer, we do random brood counts. Anytime you see a hen with a bunch of young, how many have survived in there? And you're just getting a sample. It's in a sense, kind of like an exit poll. You don't want to have to talk to everybody. You'll get the count of the votes later, but let's just talk to a sample of people. And from that, we'll get an idea of where it's trending anyhow. And that's what we do is get some averages. From there, we extrapolate what we think has been added to the population, and then we allow the that to be the huntable quota for the year. And so what happens in waterfowl, especially for ducks, the federal government sets a framework, whether it's a conservative, an average, or a long season, 30, 45, or 60 days. The states can tweak that, and Wisconsin does a split season. So we have an early hunt, then we pause and we wait for a little while for the northern divers. And what we also do is we take part of our quota of blue-winged teal because they leave by the time the season's even opening. We give it to the southern states. They can take a few more of what would be allocated to Wisconsin. And they, in trade, give us some of the diving birds. So with that, we can continue to hunt every year without injuring the population as long as we stay within that margin of only taking what is being added each year. And it's why we refer to it as a harvest. It's sustainable harvest. And that's what modern hunting is. And that's the science behind it. So it sounds very simple in terms of its math, but you have to understand the habits of the birds, how to count them. Some are easier than others. And then how to gather all of that data and then take a look from there at what we're going to allow. The other variable that comes up is, say, with turkey hunting, we can take a look at the population and how many toms we think is allowable for the springtime. And then we survey also hunter success, how many of those hunters actually got a bird. And so if only one in four get it, you can have four times the number of permits because not everybody's going to actually take a bird. So that also adds into another variable into the whole mathematical formula.
Lots going on there. Mark in Sussex, we'll go to you now. Mark, what's on your mind?
I was great show as usual.
Thank you.
I was wondering why mallards will nest out in a field that looks like perfect bobolink habitat. And it's long ways from any water, but I've seen them nesting out in these open fields.
Yeah, good question. You know, some of our ducks will nest more than a half mile from the nearest water, especially out in the Dakotas. There's our typical quacking of the mallard. So they're upland nesters. They need tall grass as a secure area where to lay those eggs. And then they need to take those young when they hatch and take them to the brood water. That's both the safety, they're out away from predators on that water, and that's where the food is, usually the small insects and vegetable material. And so especially out in the Dakotas, which is the waterfowl biologists refer to it as the duck factory. It is the highest concentration of waterfowl production in the world. And where you've got the prairies and these little ponds and wide open sweep of grassland, sometimes your nest might be a bit of a distance from that water where you find secure nesting area. And then that little bit of danger, get those young to that nearest brood water so you can rear them.
Mark, thank you for calling. Don in Gratiot, we'll go to you now. Hi, Don.
Hello. Yeah, I got a question about cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
The other day I saw a male cardinal with a black bill, and that was different from the orange bill that they have. Wondering why.
This is a young one. And when the young ones are first hatched out, they actually have the color of the female, and then slowly they'll go through a molt, and they'll get the adult color, and then that bright red is really more intense in the breeding season, so the bill color will actually intensify too.
There you go.
Yeah, you've got a younger bird.
A younger bird, Don. Thank you for calling. Robert in Middleton, it's your turn now. Hi, Robert.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment that people hopefully will find interesting, and then that leads to a question about Oreos. I've tried very hard to get Oreos over the years, and now I have probably two or three dozen different individuals, mostly Baltimore, a pair or two of orchard Oreos. But twice in 25 years, I've seen this. I've seen a mature, brilliant, very large male bird fly in, land on the branch above my two feeders, and then was followed once by three babies and once by four. And then he flew down, grabbed a bill of grape jelly, went up and gave each one of them in turn a bite of the grape jelly. And sat there, looked at him like, okay, guys, you're on your own. And then he flew off.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that twice.
Oh, great.
And I thought that was really incredibly. And then they sat there, and then the bravest one went down, and eventually they all went down to get their own little nibble of dessert.
Yeah, that's that teaching period.
Yeah. Well, my question is, do birds teach their young? For instance, will those Oreos teach the young how to catch insects? Will seed feeders teach the young how to find seeds?
Good question. There is a little bit of that involved there. It's something that's going to be difficult to observe. As you said, you've only seen it twice in 25 years. So to really be able to catch that and see how much of that is going on, how much is instinct and how much of the parents are actually trying to help them out, I think it's a combination of each, that there's some instinct there, but the parents have to teach them to perfect that a little bit and to learn a little. So swallows, you can't completely teach them how to catch insects out of the air, but they certainly do help them a little bit to take them where that food is. They will capture some and bring it to them and then try to indoctrinate them a little bit and get them independent. But yeah, that's a good question and probably varies a little bit from species to species as well.
Robert, thank you for calling. Let's turn to Kay in Maryland next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I have a question on turkey vultures.
Mm-hmm.
In the springtime, we have huge flocks of them circling town. And now, are they the ones that look like they have fingers on the end of their wings? Or
yes.
Is that a different? Okay, then they are turkey vultures.
Yes.
I wasn't sure. And I got the pathology thing you guys told us about.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can, you know, just set your phone out and it tells you what birds are there.
Yes.
I listen to the turkey vulture, and that's the most horrid thing I've ever heard.
They're usually very silent. They don't really produce a lot of sound, and if they do, it's more often than right near the nest site, just a hiss. Yeah, it's not what we call a bird song, is it? No.
No.
A hoarse screech.
Okay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mark in Winnicotty emailed to say about 3 years ago they saw for the first time a yellow-headed blackbird in their neighborhood. Now they see dozens. Are they new to the area, or did Mark just not notice them earlier?
Well, yellow-headed blackbird is a bird of deep water marshes, and they're more common west of here out in the prairies. They are punctuated a bit in specialized marshes as little kind of loose colonies. And sometimes over the years, those colonies move around. So we do have a population at Horicon. Sometimes we'll see a number of them near a trail or the roadside where they are visible. If they move it deep into the interior of the marsh, they may become far less visible to the public. So, yeah, it's a rather unique bird for us.
Kent in Reedstown emailed to say they have three different bird boxes, and between May 28 and June 1st, there were chicks in the boxes, but they were dead by early June. It wonders if gnats were killing the babies.
Well, you do have feather mites and nest mites. These are insects that will live down in that nest material, come up in the evening and feed from the blood from the young, and they can cause mortality. That's why it's important to clean out the boxes so we can keep that down a little bit to reduce and remove those populations. Just like with your garden, you want to get all the old stuff out because that harbors the disease for the next year's crop. So, yeah, you want to keep that clean. Also, like earlier, we talked about the tree swallow. It could have also been that, the starvation of the young.
Yes,
yep,
as well. For the first time tomorrow, the Wisconsin Legislative Council Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes is meeting. What's the significance of this committee?
They're looking into a proposal for holding the first ever crane hunt in Wisconsin. And this is a very emotional issue, and it's certainly something that can be quite controversial among people. The issue comes up because, yes, as crane populations have increased, there's also been an increasing amount of crop damage for the farmers. And in the past, and this is still actually holds, the only way that we have currently under legislation paid for crop damage for animals comes from hunting license fees. So when deer do damage, we use the money from the license sales. So it's not tax money, but that's what compensates the farmer for it because, we've got a lot of deer here and the farmer is incurring that loss because of those deer. And we want to make sure that if he's so-called feeding those deer out there, that this is not a hardship and an economic loss. So the hunters provide them money. And the legislators have said they would not want to pay compensation unless we had a hunting season. So now it's become a bit of a political issue. I would not sell it, though, however, that this is what's going to solve the problem for the farmers. And now let me explain. When I worked at Horicon Marsh, I started there when Dick Hunt was still working as the waterfowl and wetlands research team leader. And he's in the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame because he actually developed a program for hunting to address crop damage at Horicon. By the 1970s, we had 250,000 geese at Horicon. And there was fears about disease epidemics among such a flock, and the flocks would get into the farm fields, and they could just devastate a field. So you can imagine 10,000, 20,000 geese in a field. They can clean a farmer out in 3 days. So we designed a program where we had hunting, which was different periods, yeah, and also only one goose a day. And I used to have hunters coming up and go, "Well, God, you guys, you got to give me 3 permits, but I have to keep coming back. I could have shot them all the first day." Well, the idea is it wasn't how many geese we shot, but you put a hunter in a field, he may shoot only one goose that day, but he's just chased the 10,000 out. The problem for cranes comes down to that they're doing the damage in spring and we want to hunt them in fall. It's not going to alleviate that. And the last thing is that it's a learned behavior. A few individuals are the ones that are causing the damage, and we may not shoot the culprits who's causing the damage. So it's not going to work.
Bill Volker, thank you so much. Bill Volker, retired wildlife educator. Great to have him with us to talk birds and birding. And he will be back, and we will do this all over again with him. Coming up, we're going to take a look at your bicycle and trips that you can take on your bike and how to fix your bike. And our next guest will be coming up right after this look at the news.